And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 30th, 2020. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How are you doing, Mariah?
I am well, and I am looking forward to our discussion today. We're going to take a deep dive into Trump's climate plans for the upcoming election and Biden's climate plans for the 2020 election. A little compare and contrast today.
Good, good, good. Here as we cruise through the dog days of summer. Summertime, living's easy, I think they say, except if you're in COVID lockdown or something.
Right.
Well, one of the intriguing things about this languid, uneventful summer, where the breeze is just blowing through the trees. One of the uneventful things here is that there's a presidential campaign going on, which you might think the future of our nation hinges on the outcome. Not to put too much pressure on anybody. one of the interesting things that we wanted to do, since this is a podcast about climate, is to essentially take a moment to compare and contrast the platforms as they relate to climate of the two major presidential campaigns, which of course happen to be Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden. And I think it's a useful comparison, and we will just go through it without prejudice, as they used to say. Right? Let me just tell you the story of what I found out about what the Trump administration claims is its policy, not claims, it is their policy. If you go to the whitehouse.gov under energy and environment, it says things like, Americans have long been told that our country is running out of energy, but we now know what that is wrong. America's energy revolution has produced affordable, reliable energy for consumers, along with stable, high-paying jobs, all while dropping carbon emissions. So I think the president's campaign, as far as energy and environment goes, in particular climate, is that energy production is a good thing. If you look on the Trump campaign website, it's called promiseskept.com. You see things like the Department of Interior has proposed its largest oil and gas lease of over 78 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico. President Trump and his administration acted aggressively to increase exports of energy resources to the global market. Mr. Trump has approved infrastructure and provided resources needed to unleash oil and gas production. This is all under a title, Energy and Environment. President Trump rescinded President Obama's costly clean energy plan and has instead proposed the Affordable Clean Energy Rule. President Trump has announced his intent to withdraw the U.S. from the unfair Paris Climate Agreement. So, if you're a voter considering who you want to vote for, that's one option, is to vote to support that kind of policy under the heading of energy and environment. Right? Those are the facts. On the flip side is the Democrat, Mr. Biden, has recently proposed what I'm told is the second plank of a three-plank platform. And the second plank has to do with climate, which is why we would focus on it in this kind of a show. And the headline for the Biden plan is to spend $2 trillion over the next several years in an attempt to conform to something like the Green New Deal concepts. And that is another option that you could choose to. Comparing the presidential campaigns as far as environment, you have on the one side Mr. Trump's proud support for increasing America's energy fossil fuel production. And on the flip side, you have Mr. Biden, who promises a $2 trillion plan to generate clean energy. And some of the highlights, I'll just list them.
Yeah.
Again, it's
I can jump in too with those, Ted, if you
please
want.
Please do. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here that's very exciting, although we can talk a little bit about some of the things that are maybe tiny little red flags. But as far as the power sector, Biden wants by 2035 to get the country running on 100% emissions-free electricity, right? So that sounds pretty good. It's aggressive, mm-hmm. right? By 2035, we want to be emissions-free. And talking about transit, getting the cleanest, safest and fastest rail system in the world is another one of the highlights. Buildings, you know, I think one of the folds of this, of his climate plan, as you say, it's sort of in lockstep with the Green New Deal. And the Green New Deal is also about creating jobs. And so Biden's got a big focus on let's transition to a green economy, clean green economy, and create a lot of jobs. And so he talks about buildings and how he'd be able to create 1 million well-paying union jobs to upgrade 4 million buildings and weatherize 2 million homes so that they're energy efficient, right? And, you know, weatherizing homes is you need basically a caulking gun and a clipboard, and you go in and you figure out where do you need to sort of help it. I mean, it's a fantastic job. There's a ton of work there, and it's a great fix as a first step towards addressing energy use. More jobs created, another million jobs created to electrify the country's car, bus, and truck fleets. And in addition, building electric charging stations all over the country. $400 billion allocated to research and development of renewable energy technologies, taking a deep dive into sustainable agriculture and conservation, creating a civilian climate corps, right? Climate Corps, which is, you know, the CCC, wasn't that part of FDR?
The original, yes.
Right.
As an aside, I can remember my father. So my father grew up during the Depression, and he was in Massachusetts, and his buddy joined the Civilian Conservation Corps. He was getting sent to Wyoming, and my father was quite impressed. The guy was going to get sent all the way to Wyoming, but it turns out he was being sent to Wyoming, Rhode Island from Massachusetts. But the Civilian Conservation Corps was a original New Deal era thing that put people to work doing constructive jobs. And so it's a good thing.
And I know it did a lot of work out in Yosemite to get it. When I myself worked out in Yosemite, we talked a lot about the CCC and how much they did for creating trail systems and getting people to the park. Mm-hmm. There's also a big part of the Biden's bill that is dedicated to environmental justice, which is, of course, is a critical piece of this. Redressing racial and economic inequality by directing 40% of that $2 trillion investment to communities that are hardest hit by pollution. You know, of course, we've seen how communities hit by pollution are more likely to be affected by COVID-19 in worse ways too, right? So we know that this is a really, really important piece. So he's got 40% of that going towards addressing some of those injustices. So
forgive me for interrupting you. There's an article in the Globe. I think I can still link to it, pointing out how communities of color are more exposed to pollution from transportation, as to say along Routes 93 and the Tobin Bridge and whatnot. And that, of course, is linked to the COVID vulnerability, right? So you're back to the links of the environmental justice links that I think this plan hopes to address, right? But there's examples of it right here in Massachusetts.
Yeah. And then, you know, in sort of taking a critical look at it, there's a couple things, right? So what's good about this in a lot of ways is that Biden has come far along. His initial climate plan, you know, was very weak. He was getting Fs from some of the environmental groups in terms of his climate plan. Not all of them, you know, some of them gave him a C or C plus or one thumb up instead of three thumbs up. It depended on which platform you were looking at, right? So he's come very far in this plan. And in fact, Jay Inslee, if we remember him, he was he's the governor of Washington who ran for president on a full on climate change platform. Like, he was the climate change candidate. Well, Tom Steyer was too. Inslee said, you know, this is a good plan. I think he even called it visionary. You've got a good little stamp of approval there. And I think that Bernie also sort of pulled Biden along to get this plan kind of moving. So, you know, he's really come a long way in terms of making sure he's got something that he can get people excited about. But what's interesting about it, there's a couple things to note, right? So if we take note of the fact that the United States has spent well over $2 trillion just on the coronavirus crisis, right? So yep. Like that $2 trillion number sounds really big, but you put it into perspective and maybe it's not that big. You know, so some folks are saying, look, this doesn't go far enough. Of course, David Wallace Wells called it hopelessly inadequate. And we'll remember David Wallace Wells is the one who wrote not Hot Housers. That was Eric Holthaus, I think. David Wallace Wells wrote
Uninhabitable Earth.
Uninhabitable Earth. Thank you. Talking about how we're basically doomed in some ways. So maybe everything is hopelessly inadequate to him. But, you know, at any rate, it's worthy of note that it doesn't please everyone, even though it has come quite far from where he was, which is good.
I think it's a so let's just say that what we hope to present is a factual comparison of the stances towards climate change issues of the two campaigns that are running for president, right? No recommendation about what you ought to do, but you now have more facts, perhaps, than you had when we started this discussion, right? It's fair to say there's two clearly different visions of the world being presented here. I guess what's interesting for me, Mariah, so there's a ton of detail in the Biden $2 trillion plan, right, which we don't have the capacity to go into, I think. But I guess I'll ask you, maybe I'll say, but I mean, the very fact that such a thing exists, Joe Biden didn't pull this out of the air, right? I think it's a remarkable development in American politics and certainly American sort of left of center politics that we even have gotten to a point where a major presidential campaign can stake a promise of so much money on this kind of topic. I mean, do you find that the case?
Yeah,
are you heartened by that?
I mean, absolutely. But I'm also, it's sort of disgusting that here we are, 30 years after it was a big enough issue, right? Why wasn't it a campaign issue 30 years ago when we really could have done something about it? So, you know, but that you crying over spilled milk doesn't get you very far. So in that sense, yes, it's, thank goodness this is now, you know, a big part, like you said, it's one of the legs on the three-legged stool that Biden is, or one of the planks. Right. The second plank, right? That's a big deal, and it's about time. But at least it's happening.
I think that one of the things that I've seen is that the underlying, I just think it's a lot. The main thrust of these plans are to provide jobs. Right. That's what it means. So in some sense, again, what I've absorbed from different things is that this plan represents a recognition that we're not going to go back to the way things were. Right. The old normal. We can't go back. And that is true, I think, on many, many levels. It's this philosophical ground shift. It has nothing to do with the presidential campaigns, really. But I mean, I was saying before the COVID hit, that we can't go back to the way things were before President Trump arrived. Right? To go back to, you know, I don't want to go back to 2016 where they're going to impeach Hillary and hold her in front of the Senate for 11 hours, right? That's just craziness. That's not where we want to go. Now we're even more advanced to the point where the COVID says we only go forward. We have to build something new. And I think that's almost a societal recognition that the Biden campaign is just kind of reflecting back to us, right? This is like, you know, there's only one way. The only way out is through, is to build. I think he keeps going to build it better. But I think that represents more than just politics, or more than just presidential politics. I think that's fair.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely need to emerge from this reinvented, reimagined, or we're just going to end up churning our, you know, turning our wheels again and not getting where we need to go.
Yeah. The other two things that I find interesting about the possibility of policies as proposed in this climate plan is twofold. I mean, the two things that come to mind. One is that the Congress, as it's currently constituted, is, I think, sclerotic is the right word. I guess that's not a word. I mean, that sounds like a medical word. I think it means it's not working, or it's so, the blood vessels are so decayed that the thing is about to die. But I mean, as it stands right now, you couldn't imagine Congress passing a $2 trillion package because there's just so much opposition, right? We can see even as we speak that there's certain members of Congress are afraid that you might get lazy and not want to rush back to work at the at your dangerous essential job and not handing out money. So, I mean, one of the things that follows on from this idea of a big climate package is that how would you actually pass it? And you get into topics like, will you end the filibuster, right? Which is a highly political question, right? And have you, let me put you on the spot, have you reached an opinion, or are you still learning about whether or not the filibuster deserves to get the boot?
I can't provide a compelling argument, but I do think that the filibuster has to go. It seems like it's become something that's abused and not really used for good intent, and can get in the way of important decisions that move the country forward. Like I said, that's not a great argument. I think it was Warren, right? Elizabeth Warren had some pretty good opinions about why we need to get rid of the filibuster. I remember reading those and finding them compelling.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that it's the trade-off is between a Senate that looks more like the House in the sense that it's everyone gets told how to vote. Right. Much more. Whereas now all these guys, mostly guys, and hopefully more women as we go forward, but mostly guys can just like hold things up because they're, you know, in a bad mood. I mean, that's both good and bad if it's applied in an honest way. But I agree with you. I think that right now it's things like the filibuster are applied in a ways that are abusive and just stop the government from functioning. I don't have a great legal justification for getting rid of the filibuster, other than that it's mostly been used to prevent racial progress, right? It's back to the that whole topic. And so there's that. I mean, in for people who are thinking about this, you know, what are we going to do? Dealing with the questions of how will Congress function? Who will be in Congress? How will it function starting in January 2021? It's a big deal, right? And it's something you need to learn about because it's important. You may not like it particularly, but it's good to understand what these guys are talking about, what the choices are. I guess the other thing that strikes me about these big, big plans, and it goes across the board, is the question of how the stuff's going to get paid for. Right. And we've talked about whether or not this kind of big spending is going to be limited by some. I mean, it can't be limited by what's called the PAYGO rule, PAYGO, that if you want to spend $2 trillion, you have to take $2 trillion out of some other part of the budget. Right. I mean, that's almost impossible. Right? It's not going to happen. And so if your philosophy of governing requires that you don't do that, then we're dead in the water. And I think we need some new thinking there, right?
Yeah, there's a couple things that sort of come to mind, and I don't have, again, great detail about this, but I mean, the first is how do we pay for COVID, right? It was an emergency and we made it happen because people were dying. They are dying. And you take the measures you have to save people when lives are at stake, and climate change puts lives at stake. We don't recognize that the way that we should, but it clearly does. We have abundant evidence that shows that. I think, as you mentioned, Bangladesh, right, is currently going underwater. Parts of it are going underwater. And of course, all of the natural disasters have taken lives already. That's not okay, right? So there's that. But also, there is Mark Jacobson out of Stanford University has put together a lot of information about how many jobs and how much money transitioning to a renewable energy economy can create, how it can stimulate the economy. And so there's a lot of good financial reasons, financial payback toward shifting to renewable energy. And of course, some of that is predicated on being the first one there and on having the technology and innovation that other people start picking up. We're late to that game. But that doesn't mean that we can't still be helping. And of course, just having the technology and innovation is not the only way that you recoup some of the money from this. It's also the job creation and so on and so forth. So.
Well, and it's generally the improvement in the economic status of everyone, right? And that's, I guess the take-home lesson for me, as far as this goes, is that as climate hawks, we should not be shy or taken aback by the idea that there's a big sum of money to be spent. We can't be cowed by people who would ask us where we're going to get the, you know, once you hear the question, where are you going to get the $2 trillion? You know that person is just interested in delay, predatory delay, as they call it, right? I mean, this, however you justify the money, whether it's the war in Iraq, whether it's the $2 trillion tax cut that we gave away a couple of years ago, I mean, all these things that we seem able to do when we want to, it's just, again, it's as we go forward, climate hawks should be aware that one of the big arguments is going to be about how to pay for it, and that's a sham argument. I don't really think it's appropriate to go down the modern monetary theory rabbit hole, because there's a lot of information there. But if you're interested, read Stephanie Kelton's book called The Deficit Myth. It will make you think differently about how all these things go. Well, there you go, Mariah. Let me say that we're going to put up links to at least some of the stuff that we talked about in the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog as soon as I get through my summertime doldrums and get back to posting a few of the podcasts of the hot links up on the MCAM blog. If you want, send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should be talking about. You can listen to us on your smartphone using the application you're using now, but you should tell all your friends that they can find us on their favorite podcast application, podcast distribution application, by looking for the Climate Minute and searching in particular for association with the words Massachusetts Climate Action Network. I want to thank D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support that bolsters our weekly discussions. Right, Mariah?
Without D.R.,
we'd be dead helpful. In the water. I want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Very cool.